Good morning. Thank you for being here today. In our Zen practice, we are often told that the great matter that we must resolve is the matter of birth and death. It is the great mystery. And certainly anyone who has sat for any length of time, particularly in Sesshin, at some point contemplates one's own mortality. There may even be some who feel that they have resolved the issue, that physical death is, of course, inevitable, but that's okay. When we die, we just die. And is that all there is to it? We think we have let go of everything, even our lives. But is there yet something that we cling to? Might there not be something left, like ashes in the fireplace? Case number 29 in the Hekigan Roku. Da suis, it goes along with everything else. The case reads, a monk asked Da Sui, when the conflagration at the end of the kalpa sweeps through and the great cosmos is destroyed, I wonder, is this one destroyed or not? Da Sui said, it will be destroyed. The monk said, will it be gone with everything else? Da Sui said, it will be gone with everything else. And Shui To's verse. In the light of the conflagration ending the age, he poses the question. The patch-robed monk is still lingering within the double barrier. How touching! For a single phrase, going along with that, intently he traveled out and back for 10,000 miles. We don't know a great deal about Master Da Sui, whose Japanese name is Daizui. In the entire canon of koans which we work on at this center, this is the only one in which he appears. His dates are 878 to 963 of the Common Era, which puts him at the very end of the Tang Dynasty in ancient China. He was a grandson in the Dharma of Baizhang, Hyakujo, and also studied with Guishan, Isan, and assisted him. For many years, he lived as a recluse in Sichuan province, living in the hollow of a large tree. Baizhang was not only the teacher of Guishan, he was also the teacher of Huang Bo, Obaku, who was the teacher of Linji, Rinzai. So Da Sui is something of a Dharma cousin of Linji, and very much a part of our Rinzai lineage. We also know from this koan that he was hardcore. He gave not an inch. As is typical, we know almost nothing about the monk. Old, young, tall, short, thin or robust. But we can certainly see something of his state of mind from his question. A monk asked Da Sui, when the conflagration at the end of the kalpa sweeps through and the great cosmos is destroyed, I wonder, is this one destroyed or not? This one, will it be destroyed or not? It will be destroyed. No, but will it, just this one, be gone with everything else? It will be gone with everything else. Fear has many faces, many forms. there is the fear of the loss of loved ones, fear of loneliness, fear of poverty, fear of the disapproval of others, and, of course, the fear of death. There are some koans that deal directly with death and dying. In case number 47 in the Wu Men Guan, it's the Mumon Kan, Do Shuai's second barrier reads, "When you have realized your self-nature, you are free of birth and death. When the light of your eyes falls, how are you free?" And his third barrier reads, "When you are free of birth and death, you know where to go. When your elements scatter, where do you go?" In case 55 in the Hekigan Roku, Dao Wu, accompanied by his disciple Qian Yan, went to pay his condolences at the house of a man who had just died in the neighborhood of their temple. Qian Yan, tapping the coffin, said, "Alive or dead?" Dao Wu said, "I won't say alive and I won't say dead." Qian Yan said, "Why won't you say?" Dao Wu said, "I won't say." On their way home, Qian Yan said, "Teacher, if you don't tell me, I will hit you." Dao Wu said, "You may hit me if you like, but I won't say." Qian Yan struck Dao Wu. Later, Dao Wu passed away. Qian Yan went to Shi Shuang and brought up the foregoing story. Shi Shuang said, "I won't say alive, and I won't say dead." Upon these words, Qian Yan had a realization. Both these cases ask us to confront our own mortality. And we also practice a meditation on death. But is all this complete? Is there still some little corner of the mind that says, "Oh, I will die, but I'm not afraid. I'm okay with death because this one, that which is unborn and undying, goes on forever." Ashes in the fireplace. That leaves the door open for something else. Another fear. A darker and a deeper one. It is the dark, nameless, cosmic terror that rises up in the night, dwarfing and overwhelming all other fears and everything else. It is the terror that leaves one sweating, heart pounding, the mind in chaos. There is no cure, no antidote. One can only wait it out, or take long, endless walks through midnight streets along the edge of the abyss. Walk and walk until the morning, thank God, finally dispels the blackness, and the terror recedes and is even forgotten for a while. The 19th century Russian writer Leonid Andreev, in a terrifying story entitled Lazarus, describes in detail what happens to those who look into the eyes of Lazarus after he arose from the dead. All objects seen by the eye and palpable to the hand became empty, light and transparent, as though they were light shadows in the darkness. And this darkness enveloped the whole universe. It was dispelled neither by the sun nor the moon nor by the stars, but embraced the earth like a mother and clothed it in a boundless black veil. Into all bodies it penetrated, even into iron and stone, and the particles of the body lost their unity and became lonely. Even to the heart of the particles it penetrated, and the particles of the particles became lonely. The vast emptiness which surrounds the universe was not filled with things seen, with sun, moon, or stars. It stretched boundless, penetrating everywhere, disuniting everything, body from body, particle from particle. In emptiness, the trees spread their roots, themselves empty. In emptiness rose phantom temples, palaces and houses, all empty. And in the emptiness moved restless man, himself empty and light, like a shadow. There was no more a sense of time. The beginning of all things and their end merged into one. In that very moment, when a building was being erected, and one could hear the builders striking with their hammers, one seemed already to see its ruins, and then emptiness, where the ruins were. A man was just born, and funeral candles were already lighted at his head, and then were extinguished. And soon there was emptiness, where before had been the man and the candles, and surrounded by darkness and empty waste, man trembled hopelessly before the dread of the infinite. In more modern times, this has been called existential angst, the deep and bottomless despair that comes with the suspicion that one is not, that there might not be a self at all. And even if there is one, it can only end in death. And not just in death, but in total and utter extinction. This is, of course, the question, or the fear, of a young man named Siddhartha Gautama, as he rode through a village and encountered an old man, a sick man, and a dead man. And he saw the transience, the impermanence of everything. Dainen Katagiri Roshi describes three kinds of suffering. There is physical suffering, birth, life, sickness, old age, and death. There is mental suffering, being apart from loved ones, being with those you don't like, not getting what you want, or getting what you don't want. Attachment to the self, the five skandhas, the aspects of personality. These are the usual suspects, the kind of suffering fairly evident to all of us. But there is a third kind of suffering. Katagiri calls it radical suffering. It's a suffering that may not even surface explicitly until one has been practicing for a while. Katagiri writes, "Radical suffering is a very basic or fundamental suffering. Radical suffering is the suffering produced by the transiency of phenomena. Realization of this suffering is something you can experience through deep practice or through deep understanding. When your mind is busy and noisy, it is very difficult to have this experience. Only when your practice is moving along very deeply will you experience this kind of suffering. This suffering is very calm, very still, and very silent, but still it is there. It is very difficult to be free from radical suffering. It is a kind of fear, a very deep fear, coming from the bottom of the human mind and body. You cannot explain it, but it is always there. You have to face this suffering too. You have to face this suffering too. There is no way around, no sidestepping. It is always there. The only way out of suffering is through suffering." Some of those who encounter this radical suffering are lucky. They have teachers. The young Buddha-to-be had his fourth encounter with a monk who spoke to him and encouraged him to pursue his question, his suffering. Our monk in this koan had a practice and a teacher. In such cases, this fear, this angst, can be a spur to deeper practice and eventual realization. Others are not so fortunate. There is real danger here. Such an insight, if it is deeply felt, can be devastating. It can lead to nihilism and despair. The Buddha, it led to study, practice, and full enlightenment. Andreyev, it drove to suicide. But wait, what of the emptiness? This one, the void, what of the unborn, undying it? What of the absolute, the ground of being, our essential nature, our Buddha nature? Don't we spend countless hours on the mat in and out of Sesshin just to catch even the barest, most fleeting glimpse of the vast and quiet emptiness, the peace that passeth all understanding of that which was never born and will never die? What of that? When the universe collapses at the end of the kalpa, does it go along with all the rest? Yes, it has to. If not, the Buddha is a fraud, the Dharma a pack of lies, and the Sangha a gang of deluded fools. What do you aim for in your practice? Emptiness? The void? The ground of being? Your self nature? Buddha nature? Beware. They are traps. Have you found emptiness? Have you built a nest there? Or in your true nature? Or in just this one? Are you comfortable then? Then you are lost. Our monk got a little too comfortable in this one. He had found a home and he didn't want to lose it. It had become a self. His self, his being. And he was fearful of loss of self, of not being. The old trap. Instinctively, the self clings to something, anything, an immortal soul, an essence, even emptiness, or a concept of emptiness. Even that is some kind of being. It is the hardest of all attachments to cut loose. But let's give this monk credit. He must have wondered, doubted something. For at last he has the wherewithal to ask, to question it, to question even his Buddha nature. He now knows radical suffering. And like all suffering, radical suffering is a gift. Da Zui is not about to deprive him of this gift, this question. Thus, Da Zui says, it goes along with all the rest. Our separate self is always in doubt about its own existence, and justifiably so. All of our strivings, yearnings, scheming and dreaming are accumulation of fame, wealth, love, security, and all the rest of it, is about trying to confirm the existence of something that does not exist and never has. So naturally, since this self doesn't exist, it can never be satisfied. All that effort is pouring our lives down a black hole. And if we doubt our own self-existence, how can we be certain of the existence of anything? Take a moment here. Drop whatever you're thinking. Drop this talk. Just sit. Just breathe. Follow your breath minutely, moment to moment. to moment. Whatever enters your sight, your hearing, your consciousness, let it enter. Whatever leaves, let it go. Let it all move on. Is there anything that stays of itself? Anything at all? If you think something stays, look at it carefully. Does it remain fixed, unchanging in your mind forever? Are you sure? Or does it come and go? And if it returns, is it exactly the same? Or has it been reinvented, modified according to changing circumstances? And can you ever tell? A verse in Identity of Relative and Absolute by Master Sher To that we recite every day in Sesshin reads, "In darkness there is light, but do not look for that light. In light there is darkness, but do not try to understand that darkness." No, do not look for the darkness with the mind as we commonly use it. In that darkness there will be no thinking, no reflection, nothing to think about, no one to think, no one to reflect. We hear a lot of stuff about how modern high-energy physics is headed in the same direction as spiritual practice. I don't think so. Any scientific project or enterprise is about time and space. Not always about Newtonian time and space or Einsteinian space-time, but there is always implied the search for a concept, some new way of thinking about an ultimate reality, some new theory. But you see, that can never reach it. Equations are just more concepts, very useful ones, even profound ones, but concepts nonetheless. And concepts are always, always about space and time. The religious life does not exclude the world of time and space. But where we get into trouble is when certain New Age teachers try to bring the void, the unthinkable, the unknown and unknowable, into the scientific realm, the knowing realm of time and space. It seems an odd thing to say, but although the light and the dark are not separate, you can't mix them up. You can't recruit a conceptual void as a kind of convenient metaphysical shortcut. Any such notion as timeless life is a contradiction. Life is time. Life is change. Birth, growth, decay, and death. If it is something we think of as life, it is not timeless. If it is timeless, it is not life or anything the mind takes hold of. The creation of space-time is how we create and define the separate self. We separate out our self by creating a timeline in which we definitely exist, but therefore outside that timeline we definitely don't exist. How much time do we carry with us? How much of the past? How much of the future? What parts of ourselves do we call the past, and why do we call it the past? What are the characteristics of the past, and what do we attribute to it? The feeling of fixed, can't change, regret and sorrow, guilt, shame, pride also, maybe satisfaction, nostalgic yearnings, and above all, endless, endless replays of what should have been, might have been, wished had been. If only I had married that woman or man. If only I had finished school. If only I had bought Microsoft at 5. only I'd had children or not had them. What parts of ourselves do we call the future, and why do we call it the future? What are the characteristics of the future? What do we attribute to it? A feeling of uncertainty, not fixed, possibilities, desire, hope, anxiety, anticipation, apprehension, and endless scenarios of what we want, hope for, might happen, should happen, maybe won't happen, and on and on. If such a timeline really existed, like a railroad track, stretching from some infinite past through the present and on to an infinite future, and we are somehow moving along that timeline, seems to me that we would have perfect recall. After all, if the past were really fixed, immutable, then why would there be all these shifting and uncertain memories? If the future is likewise a fixed entity in a simple chain of cause and effect, then it should be completely predictable. Why would we have any doubts about tomorrow, or next year, or the next century? But whatever the truth of the matter, as far as our own experience is concerned, neither past nor future have any solid reality. The timeline is necessarily of a finite length, always including a beginning and an end. Our existence is by definition limited. It is bounded by the events of birth and death. We use those events to define our being as distinct from non-being. Before the created boundary of birth, we say that we do not exist. From birth onward, we say that we exist. After the created boundary of death, we do not exist. So, in between birth and death, we have this timeline along which we move, we think, and we exist from birth to death. A kind of royal road to nowhere. And, of course, we try to extend that timeline for as long as we can. Yeah, we want to stretch that baby out. But no matter how far we stretch out that line between birth and death, or from previous lives, as in that whole business of karma and rebirth, sooner or later it catches up with us, and there we are. Or maybe there we aren't. What applies to this concept of the personal self applies equally to the concept of the universe. If we posit the existence of a universe, or any of those other thought objects, even a concept of Buddha nature, it must also exist in time that is necessarily limited. It too will be subject to birth and death. Anything, any concept or dharma, small d, or phenomenon, is the same, limited by birth and death. The attachment to a notion of time is poison. It kills practice and awareness. Oh, I've been there, done that. I've seen it all before. It's going to be the same old thing again. How is it possible to act spontaneously, compassionately, appropriately, with all that past and future baggage hanging on? To the extent that we attach to notions of past and future, to that extent, we are slaves of time. There's a wonderful story about a Zen master whose name I've unfortunately forgotten, along with the source of the story. But it goes like this. The master, an abbot of a temple, said to his head monk, "You know, we really ought to have a great big oak tree right on this spot in the garden." The head monk said, "Teacher, if we plant a tree there, it will be 200 years before it gets that big." The master said, "In that case, there is not a moment to lose." Do you see how the head monk is a slave of time? The abbot is its master. In the Genjo Koan, Dogen writes, firewood becomes ash, and it does not become firewood again. Yet do not suppose that the ash is future and the firewood past. You should understand that firewood abides in the phenomenal expression of firewood, which fully includes past and future and is independent of past and future. Ash abides in the phenomenal expression of ash, which fully includes future and past. Just as firewood does not become firewood again after it is ash, you do not return to birth after death. Let's rewrite part of that paragraph, changing just a couple of words. Birth becomes death, and it does not become birth again. Yet do not suppose that death is future and birth past. You should understand that birth abides in the phenomenal expression of birth, which fully includes past and future and is independent of past and future. Death abides in the phenomenal expression of death, which fully includes future and past. This body-mind right now, as it abides in the phenomenal expression of body-mind, includes past and future and is independent of past and future. Dogen continues, this being so, it is an established way in Buddha Dharma to deny that birth turns into death. Accordingly, birth is understood as no birth. It is an unshakable teaching in Buddha's discourse that death does not turn into birth. Accordingly, death is understood as no death. Birth is an expression complete in this moment. Death is an expression complete in this moment. They are like winter and spring. You do not call winter the beginning of spring, nor summer the end of spring. Firewood is an expression, an event complete this moment. A cup is an expression, an event complete this moment. Each thing, life, laundry, enlightenment, compassion, our struggles on the mat, children, flat tires, are expressions complete in this moment. You yourself are an expression, an event complete in this moment. You don't turn into anything. It is sometimes said that dying begins the moment we are born. A phrase used, I suppose, to terrify people into a religious practice of some sort. But to say that winter is the beginning of spring is to miss winter. Winter! To get hung up on death in the future is to miss life right now. Life! In pushing parts of ourselves off into past or future, or off into space, which is basically the same thing, we rob ourselves of intimacy with ourselves. If I separate some part of me that I don't like into a dimly remembered past or an equally dim future, or off into the blue distance, how can I ever deal with it here and now? It becomes a vague and speculative affair that I can't really touch. And the farther away we push it, the more awful it becomes. The Big Bang at one end, Armageddon, the conflagration at the end of the kalpa, at the other. We lose intimacy, and it is only through intimacy that we can relate, truly relate to others and to the world. Action at a distance doesn't happen in physics, and it doesn't happen in practice. As we contain past and future, we need not waste energy regretting the past. We need not fear the future. This is real freedom. It is the freedom to engage fully our lives, past, present, and future, unfettered, without being trapped. Now, one might object, it's It's all very well to say such things. But here I am, at such and such an age and condition and a particular time and place. What do I do with that? This world of time and space is not a bad thing. Time and space is Buddha's creative activity. Time is created each moment. Past, present, future are created constantly and are constantly dying away. This is the natural, fundamental activity of mind. Just don't get hung up on notions of a fixed past, a foreseeable future, or even a knowable present. If we truly get this, we can dive into illusion. It is by entering fully into illusion without attachment that we function fully, spontaneously, and compassionately. This is mastery, to be free of concepts involving separate past and separate future. It's not about making them go away. We're not chasing after them. We're not running from them either. We're just not captured by them. I said a moment ago that action at a distance doesn't happen. This includes all our actions. Right action, compassionate action. There is no compassion at a distance. Compassion is proportional to the extent that there is no separation. Not in time, not in space. Yes, it is said that practice happens in time and space, but that means all of time and all of space. Our lives can only happen in all time and all space. This space-time veil is much thinner than you might imagine. It is easily rent. In the nursing home where Candy lives, there is a woman who arrived a few months ago. She was extremely angry at having to be there. She sat all day in one of the recliners or on a couch with this perpetual scowl on her face and just kind of smoldered. I think a lot of her anger had to do with the fact that she was relatively young to be there, in her early 60s, and deeply resented the fact. One day she apparently found out that Candy was younger than she was. Something happened. For a moment the barrier came down. She took off a pendant on a chain that she always wore around her neck and gave it to Candy. Since then I wave and say hello when I come in. Sometimes she smiles back. And for that moment, there are no barriers. This is what we mean when we speak of eternity. It's not some endless stretching out of time forever and ever, amen. The same holds true of infinite space. It doesn't just stretch out there forever. Eternity is to let go of notions of time. It is to become timeless. Infinity is to let go of notions of space. To let go of notions of time and space is to become intimate. This is the collapsing of space and time into the singularity of here and now. This infinite here. This eternal now. Shui Do's verse. In the light of the conflagration ending the age, he poses the question. The patch-robed monk is still lingering within the double barrier. How touching. For a single phrase going along with that, intently he traveled out and back for 10,000 miles. For this single phrase going along with that, he traveled out and back for 10,000 miles. The commentators on this koan tell us that our monk didn't get what Da Sui was telling him and traveled great distances to find a master who could explain it to him, but to no avail. But the real question is, what do we do? For that phrase, it goes along with all the rest. What will each of us do with it? Are we still lingering within the double barriers of birth and death, being and non-being, form and emptiness? Soto Master Tenkai Densan, an elder contemporary of Hakuin, writes, "The underlying meaning is that the fire that consumes the universe at the end of the eon is already upon you all. So everyone should urgently make a thorough investigation. If you waste time hanging around, you'll lose your life." When we question Mu or a koan, we question the ultimate, even as the monk questioned the ultimate, and even as Da Zui encouraged him. With every Mu, every breath, every one, it goes along with all the rest, utterly consumed in the great conflagration of your own zazen. Are there still ashes in the fireplace? Of course. We are faced with the never-ending task. Every time we seem to have penetrated the ego's last defense, uncovered the deepest secret, the self creates yet a deeper secrecy, a deeper fear, a deeper suffering. It is said that the Buddha spent 8,000 lifetimes as a bodhisattva before attaining full enlightenment. But not to worry. If we truly master time and space, it's not so difficult. And as we continue this endless quest, at some point, and I can't tell you when, it becomes a joyful journey. And the deepest suffering is magically transmuted into a quiet and ineffable joy. Together with all beings, we attain in this moment, and this moment, and this moment, Buddhahood.